Good evening. An attempt to take down Andrew Jackson's statue is thwarted, but protesters face heavy jail time. COVID-19 surges in the U.S., Daniel Ellsberg on John Bolton's new book, and a controversial march for George Floyd in Newark. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI News for Tuesday, June 23rd, 2020. A federal appeals judge in New York City compared the two lawyers accused of tossing a Molotov cocktail into an empty cop car to the Weather Underground, a 1970s radical group, at a hearing today. Lawyers for Colin Ford Mattis, 32, and Uruj Rahman, 31, were making a pitch for bail. The two had been originally allowed at-home confinement, but the feds took over the case and had the two remanded on federal arson charges. The alleged incident took place on May 30th amid a wave of protests after the killing of George Floyd. According to reports, the empty police cruiser had already been vandalized and damaged. The federal charges have a mandatory minimum of 45 years in prison. Meanwhile, last night, a group of protesters attempted to pull down a statue of Andrew Jackson standing in Lafayette Park across from the White House. The action, the latest in a worldwide groundswell aimed at monuments to avowedly racist historical figures, prompted President Trump to threaten heavy sentences against the demonstrators.
Very strong. Last night we stopped an attack on a great monument, the monument of Andrew Jackson in Lafayette Park. And I just want to thank law enforcement. They did a great job. We were working very closely with the White House Secret Service and some of our executives. It was really, they did a great job. They stopped it cold. Numerous people are in jail and going to jail today. People are already there, but we're looking at long-term sentences under the Act. We have a very specific Monuments Act, and we are looking at long-term jail sentences for these vandals and these hoodlums and these anarchists and agitators, and call them whatever you want. Some people don't like that language, but that's what they are. They're bad people. They don't love our country, and they're not taking down our monuments. I just want to make that clear. And other than that, go ahead.
Mr. President, do you have an executive order regarding the monument? What will it accomplish?
I will have an executive order very shortly. And all it's really going to do is reinforce what's already there, but in a more uniform way. Okay? I want to also say this. If the state government, because you see them all over in Seattle, they're very weak. And in Minnesota, they might need help. If they need help, the federal government is willing to help them. If these hoodlums come around, these are not protesters, by the way. These are anarchists and other things. If these hoodlums come around and if the states can't handle it, we are ready, willing, and able to help, as we did in Minnesota, where we stopped after 4 days. They finally called, and we did a great job with the National Guard.
Attorneys say out-of-proportion charges against protesters is apparently coming on orders directed by Trump to Attorney General William Barr. And Rayshard Brooks, the black man gunned down by a police officer in Atlanta on June 12th, was mourned at his funeral inside historic Ebenezer Baptist Church today. It's the church where Martin Luther King Jr. preached from the pulpit. King's daughter, the Reverend Bernice King, spoke at the private service. She said, "We are here because individuals continue to hide behind badges and trainings and policies and procedures rather than regarding the humanity of others in general and black lives specifically." Brooks is survived by his wife of 8 years, Tamika Miller, their three young daughters, age 1, 2, and 8, and a 13-year-old stepson. And cases of COVID-19 are surging across the United States, even as cases in the Northeast begin to wane. Overall cases in the U.S. have increased by 25%. Texas, Arizona, and Nevada set records in their coronavirus outbreaks, and 10 other states from Florida to California were grappling with a surge in infections. Texas reported over 5,000 new infections on Monday, a single-day record for the state. Meanwhile, the New York Times reports the European Union is prepared to block Americans from entering because of failure to control the pandemic, putting the U.S. number two in coronavirus cases in the same category as Brazil and Russia. In March, Trump banned most EU citizens from entering, sparking outrage from EU leaders. The director of the World Health Organization, Dr. Tedros Adhanom, says the disease is continuing its global march.
It seems that almost every day we reach a new and grim record. Yesterday, more than 183,000 new cases of COVID were reported to WHO, easily the most in a single day so far. The consequences of these disruptions will be felt for many years to come. The world is learning the hard way that health is not a luxury item. It's the cornerstone of security, stability, and prosperity. We urge countries to be careful and creative in finding solutions that people stay safe while getting on with their lives. We continue to urge all countries to double down on the fundamental public health measures that we know work. Finding and testing suspected cases works. Isolating and caring for the sick works. Tracing and quarantining contacts works. And protecting health workers works.
The United Kingdom has begun relaxing its lockdown, with pubs, restaurants, and hotels preparing to reopen. Prime Minister Boris Johnson says the government will allow two households to meet in any setting and all schools to reopen in September, although health officials continue to warn of reopening too quickly. And in the United States, hundreds of thousands of files from dozens of police agencies, more than 270 gigabytes worth, have been dumped online by the group Distributed Denial of Secrets. The information was posted on June 19th, marking Juneteenth. Codenamed Blue Leaks, the leak represents 10 years of data from over 200 police departments, fusion centers, and other law enforcement training and support resources. One tidbit making the rounds on Twitter are documents purporting that white supremacist biker gangs have been posing as anti-fascists in order to portray the shadowy political group Antifa as a greater threat than it actually poses. And more from Washington, D.C. The memoir from former National Security Advisor John Bolton was released Tuesday after a legal fight that lasted for a week. The White House had asked a federal judge to block the book, The Room Where It Happened, a White House memoir. Bolton had been Trump's National Security Advisor before he was fired. Federal Judge Royce Lamberth, who once headed up the super-secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, agreed that the classified information was released, but it was too late to do anything about it. Washington Post reporter Robert Costa asked Bolton if President Trump would try and stay in office even if he lost the election.
If we're not careful, I think carrying the albatross of this administration around our necks any longer than necessary is going to cause great harm to the country for sure, but to conservatives and Republicans as well. And that outcome you're describing would be absolutely the worst.
But let's pause there. You said hope so about the peaceful transfer of power. So you're not certain?
I think in the Trump administration, you can't be certain of anything.
What does that mean for the fate of this country?
Well, I think the prospects for the presidential election this November are very unhappy. Certainly for me as a lifelong conservative who started handing out leaflets for Barry Goldwater as a kid of 15, I wish we weren't faced with this choice. I wish there were a real conservative Republican on the ballot. There's not. It's not going to be a happy time. From my perspective, I hope to spend at least a little time working hard to make sure the Republican majority in the Senate is preserved. I think whether Trump wins or loses, that's absolutely critical. But at the presidential level, the prospects are not happy.
Former National Security Advisor John Bolton. Half a century ago, another autocratic president, Richard Nixon, attempted to use his attorney general, John Mitchell, a former campaign manager, to stop publication of the classified Pentagon Papers, an unflattering history of the Vietnam War prepared inside the government. The official who released the documents was Daniel Ellsberg. He says Bolton's story is not too different from his and will probably sell a lot of copies of the book.
The classification system is used primarily and mainly to avoid embarrassment for government officials or for their policy. And I'm talking about some 95% of it in a very professional estimate. Even at the time it's classified, it right. does not really deserve that. The there is some material that deserves classification for or deserves sequestering for some period of time in intelligence work. And I'm saying it's not 80% or 50% or 20%. It's about 5%. And so the presumption really is that information that is stamped with a classification mark and that does not involve all the conversation with the president does not compromise national security.
What happened in your case when the Pentagon Papers were going to be published by the Washington Post and the New York Times?
I was prosecuted. I was indicted under 12 counts, possible 115 years, for copying and holding this material. And there was going to be a later trial for the distribution of that. I was facing criminal prosecution, and the president has raised that in connection with Bolton. I've ordered his book in advance, not that I'm eager to swell his personal wealth. I certainly wish that my recent book, The Doomsday Machine, had been the subject of an attempt by Trump to stop it. That would have done marvelously for my sales, been more than worth it, and it's doing that for Bolton. I would certainly join Bolton's defense, much as I despise him for his political views, in terms of criminal prosecution. I was the first to be prosecuted criminally for putting out information I felt that the nation needed to have. And actually, I look forward to reading what Bolton has to tell us. What stopped really the government from issuing more injunctions on the Pentagon Papers was that I had given them to 17 different newspapers. So day after day, one more newspaper was defying the president and the attorney general and others who were saying that this was hurting national security. They could read it. The newspapers could see that it wasn't hurting national security. And they were, in effect, committing civil disobedience against the president on that. But after three injunctions, one of the government prosecutors said, it's like herding bees. We can't stop this. And, of course, on the same grounds, this material is all over the country now. It's distributed. It really can't be stopped. So they're going through the motions just to show that the president will use the Justice Department and Attorney General Barr as far as he can to harass individuals he doesn't like.
The Attorney General during Nixon, was he as pliable to Nixon as Barr is?
Yes. The Attorney General Mitchell, former campaign manager for Nixon, and of course who brought my indictment, was indicted actually the the day my trial ended. It led to a wonderful headline when I went to court the day the trial was ended for governmental misconduct. Attorney General Mitchell indicted his successor, acting Attorney General, who again was presiding over my trial, Kleindienst, took a plea bargain, basically. And he was indicted, or actually investigated criminally as well. So I lost two attorney generals. Yes, they were, for example, conducting enormous warrantless surveillance. I was overheard on illegal warrantless wiretaps when I was in present when on one occasion when John Mitchell was telling newspaper editors, AP Managing Editors Association, that he didn't conduct any warrantless wiretaps. And that was a lie, just as officials under Bush were lying in that respect.
Author and former government insider Daniel Ellsberg, who released the classified history of the Vietnam War, known as the Pentagon Papers. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. In education news, Vice President Mike Pence spoke in Wisconsin today, a key swing state in November's election. The subject was school choice, in other words, charter schools, which has gotten a push due to the coronavirus pandemic.
More choices, more public choices, more public charter choices, more more innovation, like at this great STEM academy that we're gathered at, and more opportunities to choose even private and religious schools.
Vice President Mike Pence. But many educators say they're alarmed by the rise of charters and what they call the growing privatization of public education. Recently, 650 educators of color and educational scholars of color across the U.S. signed on a statement calling for what they say should be a retreat from the market-based initiatives in schooling. The former dean of the School of Education at the University of San Francisco is Kevin Kumashiro. He says government subsidies are going into the pockets of billionaires.
The biggest benefactor of all of this will be the tech industry, right? Already over $13 billion have been allocated for public schools. Another $130 billion is being proposed in the fourth round of the stimulus packages. And because schools are so heavily relying on online education, this is a time when we're seeing many more people push online resources, online technology, even online virtual charter schools and other kinds of resources for educators. What we actually need to be thinking about is how the reliance on online education might actually exacerbate existing inequities, like the inequities between schools, what kind of resources people have, the inequities between homes, like whether there's Wi-Fi access and a computer at home and quiet spaces to work, but even differences between the capacity of teachers to use the technology, the capacity of students to use the technology. There's even injustices related to heavy reliance on technology, such as concerns around data privacy, concerns around accommodating students with disabilities, concerns even about how too much screen time corresponds to lower literacy development, lower math development, and problems sort of with physical health and mental health.
A lot of this stimulus money for education is really about buying computers from Apple and Dell and things like that and just giving them a chunk of the money.
For decades, there are tech industry folks as well as tech leaders who have been calling for reforming schools by technologizing schools. And this is not just folks like Rupert Murdoch. It's also first like Laureen Jobs, who actually wrote to Hillary Clinton when she was campaigning for president and said, you know, the best way to reform schools is to actually turn more and more to technology, which not only doesn't have evidence that it's going to drastically improve education. In fact, lots of studies are already coming out that in the past few months, learning has plummeted as we've relied increasingly on technology. But it also is a way to profiteer off of this moment.
Are we going in the direction of schools becoming job training operations?
One of the things that I think has been scary about the way that we've responded in the coronavirus moment is we've narrowed to this sort of emphasis on content delivery and practice, right? All we're trying to do is, in order to, quote, stay on pace and not fall behind standards, we want to keep up with delivering the content that we think students are supposed to be learning, the disciplines, the sort of lessons, and then have them practice it over and over again. To thrive in life, like all the positive outcomes we look for, achievement, job success, happiness in life, ability to interact with others positively, all of these sort of life outcomes that we want for children, it doesn't rely only on narrowly defined academic skills. What they also need to be getting are some of the things we call the soft skills, like the work habits, the social interactions, the conscientiousness, as well as the consciousness. And those are the things that we lost as we sort of overemphasize narrowly defined content in an effort to stay on pace.
What do you see as the outcome and should be the outcome of for education?
This is a time when schools should be ramping up their efforts to develop in students the capacity to be critical thinkers, to be able to read texts that are racist, to be able to make decisions about what we want our nation to look like moving forward. There's a recent statement that I helped to put together that over 650 educators of color from across the country have signed on to so far. It's called This Must End Now. And it's calling for some awareness raising about how so many of the reforms that are being foisted upon poorer black and brown communities are actually being pushed by the wealthy who know that these reforms are ways to profiteer off of public schools. We need to raise our awareness about the wrong directions of reforms and insist that we can do better in this moment.
Kevin Kumashiro is former dean of the School of Education at the University of San Francisco. In local news, an 80-year-old statue depicting former President Theodore Roosevelt on horseback, high above an indigenous man and an African man, will be removed from the front steps of the American Museum of Natural History. The building and statue are owned by the city. Theodore Roosevelt IV, a great-grandson on the museum's board, agrees. He says the statue doesn't reflect Theodore Roosevelt's legacy, adding, "It's time to move the statue and move forward." And finally, in Newark, a protest for George Floyd met opposition from the city's black mayor on Friday. The diverse protest was organized by the Newark Water Coalition, a group formed in 2018 after it was discovered that Newark's drinking water had been contaminated with lead. But the mutual aid march soon crossed paths with officials of Mayor Ross Baraka's government, who attempted to block the march.
Let him talk that. If the Trump does, it's a bad thing. First of all, number one, we have political power. Do you understand that?
Quiet down, quiet down. Quiet down, we're in conversation.
We believe in our people.
Right.
We believe in our mayor.
Right.
The mayor just created an executive order to talk about the police department.
Right.
To defund the police department.
Right.
I'm not saying wrong. It's all facts. Google it. Google it. If you want to challenge me, I'm here to listen. The problem is, you guys don't even listen to yourselves talk. You cannot come here talking about George Floyd, then pass out flyers talking about water.
Water, come on.
That's miseducation.
Right.
That's misleading.
Come on.
That's wrong.
Using our dead brother.
Well, if there are any workers here, black, Asian, Latin, white, Arab, Jewish,
no,
who
are having a conversation.
Believe that putting a politician in power is going to do anything, and that we need to organize in our schools, in the prisons, the students, everywhere.
Shut it up, or I'm going to rip it out. Shut it up, or I'm going to rip it out.
Organizing your town. Malcolm X said the ballot was the bullet.
Right.
How many of y'all got tanks? How many of y'all own machine guns?
A supporter of the mayor angrily ripping a microphone from one protester as city officials tried to stop the march. A co-founder of the Newark Water Coalition is Anthony Diaz. He says the city is falling short of its responsibility.
The Newark Water Coalition is an advocacy group that deals with the lead crisis in the city of Newark. So the narrative that comes out of the administration is that everything is fine. They're solving the problem as best as they can. They're changing the lead service lines. But the Newark Water Coalition believes they're not doing enough, that they can do a lot more in terms of education and resource allocation. And so that has always been kind of the push and pull between the Newark Water Coalition and the city administration. So we decided to do a mutual aid march in honor of George Floyd and the police brutality killings in the South Ward of Newark. And, you know, at this event, some city officials showed up. And they started pushing back and agitating the crowd. You know, some folks snatched our bullhorns. They broke another speaker. They really didn't allow us to finish the march, you know, all the way down to the police precinct. It wasn't just one city official, but there were just several organizations that are partnered with the city that took involved or that were involved in kind of physically disrupting this peaceful march.
So it seems very unusual to me, the actual officials to come down. What prompted that, do you think?
We've been such a thorn in the side of the city administration that they really are trying to dissuade our public relations in a lot of different ways. And if they can use force to intimidate us, to kind of shut up, to stop doing the work, then they're going to bring out all the measures that they can. While you're surprised, this is not shocking to us at all. This has been a constant theme of our work. And while I don't want to put it just like the Newark Water Coalition versus Roz, we believe that it's a systemic problem. We believe that it's not just an administration, just this administration, but all administrations and a governmental problem. Like, they just like to sweep problems under the rug.
Are you intimidated? What happens next?
No, we're going to still continue to do the community work. We're not intimidated. We strongly feel that we're doing the right thing. And we believe that them coming out and showing this kind of force only verifies or affirms the fact that we're doing the right thing. Because if we weren't doing the right thing, nobody would care, being that they allocated so many resources, so many personnel, and so much time to disrupting what was a peaceful march. It's almost like they're trying to stop the work that we're doing, and we're not going to stop this work at all.
Anything like to add?
I just want more people to know about this. I want people to do their research. This is just the tip of the iceberg. There's so much going on in the city of Newark that needs to be exposed and uncovered, and there's more than overwhelming evidence that this is not just a one-off, that this is a theme of this administration.
Anthony Diaz is co-founder of the Newark Water Coalition. Today is primary day in New York State. The primary was delayed by the coronavirus pandemic. Hundreds of thousands of people in the state have already voted via absentee ballot, but still there were problems at the polls. Masks were mandatory. Poll workers were armed with disinfectant and hand sanitizer. Some voters reported that they were given only a one-page presidential ballot without any local or state races when they arrived at polling sites. Others complained that sites across the city opened hours late. Absentee ballots must be postmarked by June 23rd or dropped off at polling places. The polls close at 9 p.m. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, June 23rd, 2020. The news is produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul D'Arienzo.